Welcome to Africa in Transition. This is Alan Grain at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week we have a special edition of our podcast recorded at the Oslo Humanitarian Conference on Nigeria in the Lake Chad region. At the conference, various governments pledged $672 million towards humanitarian aid. However, this amount falls far short of the $1.5 billion goal. Joining us from Oslo is Sherry Russell Brown, who was able to catch up with some of the conference's panelists: Catherine Achilles of Oxfam Nigeria, Chitra Nagarajan of Civilians in Conflict, and Mousie Segun from Human Rights Watch.
I'm Sherry Russell Brown, and I'm here in Oslo, Norway, with Chitra Nagarajan, Mousie Segun, and Catherine Achilles. Today we're going to talk about the Oslo Humanitarian Conference on Nigeria and the Lake Chad region, which was convened February the 24th. And the civil society meeting, which was held the day before, February 23rd, at which you were each panelists, right? So let's start with you, Mousie. If you can first explain a little bit about the current situation in northeast Nigeria and why the Oslo conference is important to the region.
The Boko Haram insurgency has gradually begun to wane in intensity because of some successes by Nigerian security forces with the support of government forces from neighboring countries, Chad, Cameroon, and Niger. We've seen Boko Haram on a back leg, but the group remains very resilient, still carrying out attacks against individuals, against displacement camps. But the successes of the security forces and the outcome of the conflict itself has led to massive displacement of people from their homes, mostly involuntarily, whether by Boko Haram or by the security forces, in many parts of the worst hit areas, especially in Borno State, as well as in neighboring Niger, Cameroon and Chad. People have little access to livelihoods. The security forces have also restricted their movement within the camps, meaning that they are totally reliant on humanitarian relief and aid, a lot of which is not coming for several reasons. Lack of access, like I said, because of ongoing military operations. Insecurity makes it difficult for humanitarians to reach the places where people are most at need, And then you have all the failure of harvests because there's been no planting in the past several years. It's led to massive hunger, malnutrition for children. A lot of children are dying. We have close to 2.6 million people in all displaced. A large number are children and women. Men are missing in most parts. A question that has been difficult to answer, the reason for this. I mean, we have all kinds of analysis, but nothing sure yet. And so right now, the greatest need is to meet the people where they are with food supplies, medical supplies, water, good sanitation, and education for the children to secure their future. Many of them have been out of school for up to 3 years. Adolescents who are the, you know, very important threshold of their lives cannot transit to adulthood without the skills for their lives, for their future. And so what this conference is about is raising funds to meet the gap in existing services right now, which is grossly insufficient. Those gaps are huge. In some cases, for example, for education, it's at 2%. So what this conference we've been able to do is to get pledges from donors from foreign countries, partners of Nigeria, and from the Nigerian government as well, to try and improve the levels of the services and humanitarian relief materials reaching people where they need.
Chitra, you spoke on the panel about protection and humanitarian access. Can you talk about who causes harm?
Sure, thank you very much, Sherry. We know that Boko Haram causes harm, but I think an aspect that has received less attention is the fact that harm has been perpetrated by all sides of the conflict. Research that my organization, the Center for Civilians in Conflict, did showed that although civilians themselves felt that the majority of harm had been perpetrated by Boko Haram, they felt that the Nigerian military, in their rush to defeat the enemy, had caused a lot of incidental civilian harm and also caused human rights abuses. Our report, which is available from our website, civiliansinconflict.org, found that the Nigerian military had not protected the civilian population in at least three ways. The first is that they had failed to protect them from attacks by Boko Haram and others. The second is that they had caused a lot of civilian harm through collateral damage. And the third is perpetration of human rights violations, detention, sexual exploitation, abuse, torture, etc. To address some of these issues, the Chief of Defence Staff in October committed to putting in place and implementing a civilian protection policy. The army set up a human rights desk, which, you know, investigations are underway. And they have been working with us on holding workshops for their members on ways to better prioritize civilian protection in military operations. However, we know that harm committed by the military still occurs. We've also had cases of schools and hospitals being used by the military, which not only means that they're less available to the civilian population, but also makes them targets. And often you actually have civilian populations living there, so they've become mixed-use sites with civilians on one side of the compound and the military on the other. Unfortunately, we're still seeing cases of sexual exploitation and abuse committed by the military, as well as camp officials and other IDPs. So there's quite a way to go when it comes to addressing some of these issues. And the reason why I'm talking so much about the military is I think for us, it's difficult to imagine that Boko Haram will change its approach when it comes to causing civilian harm. Mm-hmm. But the Nigerian state, in the form of its security forces, not only has a responsibility to reduce civilian harm, but a legal, an ethical, and an operational imperative to do so. Mm-hmm. And they're taking steps in this regard, which we welcome.
Okay, thank you. Kat, you were also on the protection and humanitarian access panel. What has the impact of the conflict been on livelihood on the region?
Well, what the conflict has meant across the region, and particularly in, I'll talk to the three countries that Oxfam works in, which are Nigeria, Chad, and Niger, is people, thousands of people have been displaced from their homes, from their land, from their farming, from their businesses, from their markets, and into new places. And what that means is that people either rely on humanitarian assistance, but as we know, across large parts of these areas, humanitarian assistance is very difficult and remains really challenging for agencies to reach people. Or they're pushed into really negative coping strategies in response to this. So what you have on the one hand is Boko Haram raiding villages, putting checkpoints on roads to extort from passengers, accusing traders of being spies if they're moving between places. What you also have is governments putting either formal or informal restrictions on how people's ability to access their farmlands because of, on the basis of security. Now, while there's a logic behind this tactic, what it's meant is that thousands of people have been banned from accessing traditional areas of livelihood production. So the lake is out of bounds, huge parts of farmlands are out of bounds, and it means that people can't go to them, can't produce. So what you see is, especially where people don't have access to sufficient aid, is increases in begging, particularly child begging. You have huge increases in women exchanging sex for food and non-food items like water, their ability to, you know, buy clothes. And that's associated with really significant rises in gender-based violence and rape cases, particularly in Nigeria. And particularly women going out to collect firewood, to sell firewood, and exposing themselves to risk because they're going quite far into the bush to be able to collect that, often in small groups. In Chad and Niger, where we have formal restrictions, there's states of emergencies that have been imposed. What we see is huge increases in these, but people continuing to take risks to go back into these areas because they can't survive even with these negative coping strategies that we've talked about. So what you have is men going onto the lake, and they're deeply afraid of being seen as Boko Haram members by the military and killed. So what happens is they go further away from the military zones, which exposes them to harm by Boko Haram because they're also afraid of being attacked by Boko Haram. So they're in this very difficult situation. We also see in Niger huge increases in early marriage of female children to reduce the burden of resources. And people taking daily risks. They are afraid to do this. In Chad, in Nigeria, what we hear repeatedly is that women are afraid. And because of the risks to men particularly, because there is a lot of protection risks associated, as we've discussed, with men, women are expected to take these risks on a daily basis and have to, because they have to ensure the survival of their family and themselves and their friends. And so we've got this really difficult situation where Boko Haram is dangerous, the military and government restrictions have exposed them to different types of risks and really exacerbated the dependency on humanitarian assistance, and still huge challenges getting the necessary amount of humanitarian assistance into these communities to help these people.
Thank you. Mousy, if I could just come back to you, and specifically if you could talk about the issue of education. You spoke on the panel about education, right, in emergencies. Now that the conference is over, what do you think has been achieved on the issue of the education sector and attacks on education?
So in terms of education, I think part of the goal that we had in coming to this conference is to increase the understanding of the pivotal role that education plays in this conflict. The conflict, no doubt, has, you know, affected people in all aspects of life, but education in particular, because Boko Haram specifically and deliberately targeted schools. The very name Boko Haram means Western education is haram or sinful or forbidden,
right,
in Hausa language. Now, in carrying out its ideology, its interpretation of Sharia law, it believes that education is a form of westernization and a corrupting influence on Muslims. And so it has targeted schools, teachers, students for killings. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's not just Boko Haram. You know, Chitra made a reference to this earlier. It's also the security forces. They have also targeted schools, some schools, teachers, mm-hmm, and students. This then forces the education population, let me put it that way, administrators, students, teachers, they formed the very early cross of the vigilante groups, mm-hmm, because Boko Haram on one side, security forces on the other side. I remember the principal of a school in Maiduguri saying to me that it was from his school, the government college at Maiduguri, one of the earliest schools in the Northeast, where the nucleus of the vigilante group, the civilian JTF, was given birth to, because many of the students were Boko Haram and they were threatening fellow students. Those students, working with the teachers, formed themselves into the vigilante group and then got support and fished out the members amongst them. But it made them a target for Boko Haram. By mid-2013, when the vigilante groups working with security forces pushed Boko Haram out of Maiduguri, they went out in revenge against students everywhere, teachers everywhere, killing hundreds of students, over 600 of teachers, mm-hmm, school administrators. But security forces also, in response to Boko Haram's tactics, began to target Quranic schools, students of Quranic schools, teachers of Quranic schools, and in some cases, some secular teachers who they believed were sympathetic or were part of Boko Haram. And so you find education in the mix all the way on both sides, all sides actually, because you have Boko Haram, you have security forces, and then you have the civilian joint task force, mm-hmm, the vigilante group, right, all parties to the conflict, but students and education mixed up in all of this. Now with this conference, we realized before coming to this conference that education was not getting the attention that it needed to, because of a lack of understanding of the very serious role, mm-hmm, that it plays in the conflict. And we cannot claim to succeed in, you know, neutralizing Boko Haram and its influence without addressing one, the prevailing education deficit in that region before the conflict, mm-hmm, and how that has led to the insurgency, and how the continued neglect of education will ultimately lead us back to a different form of extremism or violent rebellion, mm-hmm, out of, you know, a frustration for the years that have been lost for many children. Mm-hmm. I think that we have marginally succeeded in achieving that, in raising awareness and getting pledges to support, you know, improving access to education, making education and schools safer, protecting teachers, protecting students, and providing the infrastructure to get kids back in school, both as an emergency measure mm-hmm. and a long-term development intervention.
Now, last year, Human Rights Watch released a report on sexual exploitation and abuse. Can you tell us more about that issue?
So, it was actually something that we kind of ran into. We were researching other issues, but everywhere that we went, it constantly came up in conversation. You know, for us as a human rights organization, crimes will happen. So IDP on IDP rapes, IDP on IDP, you know, attacks would be in the normal course of policing work. But where you find that it is members of the security forces, mm-hmm. and like I said, all the parties to the Boko Haram conflict, Boko Haram on its part has, you know, massively abducted women, sexually abused them, raped them, you know, treated them in very undignifying manner. Many have escaped that into either host communities or formal government-recognized IDP camps. Okay. In those camps, you know, for example, there's a woman that I spoke to. It was one of the soldiers who had traveled with the vehicle that brought her when she escaped from Boko Haram into Maiduguri, who then, you know, approached her deceptively, initially for a friendship, for a relationship, because he knew her story. Mm-hmm. He knew that she had lost her husband, and then turned to rape her. And so, and horribly enough, it's not just women, it's also young girls. It's an abuse of a relationship. It is, you know, the scale at which it was happening, it was difficult for us, you know, to get to as many women and girls who had been victims of this because they were afraid. Mm-hmm. But we were able to talk in all to more than 60 people, 43 of whom had, you know, gone through different levels of abuse, but four very strong rape cases that we were able to showcase to the government that even though everyone knew that this was happening, long before we went in, our concern was that nothing was being done to stop it mm-hmm. and to get, you know, judicial remedies or, you know, compensation or support of any kind for the victims and the survivors of these abuses. And, you know, as our methodology is, the first thing that we did was to approach the government and all of the different authorities who had been implicated in these allegations to show them mm-hmm. what we found.
Right.
And we got no response until we put out the report. And then the government, you know, woke up and decided to look into it. But I, as happy as we are that that has happened, mm-hmm. it's happened just in response to our report, not the large-scale problem that sexual abuse of displaced women and refugees mm-hmm. has been. And what we're looking to the government for is that, you know, overarching response that makes protection and prevention of sexual abuse a priority in the humanitarian response, as a humanitarian response, and as a government obligation mm-hmm. to secure these people who've lost all that they have,
right.
you know, and beyond protection and prevention, then go on to providing support and to providing them with justice.
Chitra, obviously the SEA is a big part of how the conflict has had a gendered impact. Can you tell us about others?
Thank you. Well, I want to start by saying that sexual exploitation and abuse in a situation of conflict is to be expected. And unfortunately, despite us knowing again and again and again from different countries where violent conflict has happened, still we're surprised when it happens. It always happens. We should expect that it will happen and put in place mechanisms to prevent and respond to it before we get the first reports. Not afterwards, not wait for Human Rights Watch to produce their report and then start working on it. That's the first thing I want to say. Secondly, I want to talk about a group that we don't often talk about when we talk about gender, and that's men and boys. We often think of men and boys as perpetrators, and we all know why that's the case. But actually, in the context of the conflict in Northeast Nigeria, as in so many other conflicts, men and boys are also victims and survivors. When we look at IDP camps, they're full of women and children, and we all say this, and we say this as a way of saying, you know, they're the most vulnerable. We need to make sure that our interventions reach them, which is true. But we need to be asking the question, where are the men? If the IDPs are women and children, what has happened to the men? And we know some things that have happened to them. We know that men fled first away from the region because they felt under attack, and also because they were more able to do so, because that's the nature of patriarchal societies. Men have more choices than women. We also know that many of them were detained on suspicion by the security forces. We know that many of them have been killed. I've heard so many stories from survivors of attacks that the first thing that Boko Haram did when they came to their community was to kill all the men, and in particular, kill all the men over the age of 8. And they justify this by saying, we're killing all the men, we're sparing the women because it was a woman who gave birth to us, which is an interesting reasoning given the other things that they then do to women and girls. So for me, when we're talking about protection, we need to also talk about who's not there. We need to talk about the whole community. And I think it's very important for us as a community to think about what is our response to the missing men. Do we even investigate that this is happening? Secondly, I do want to talk about the women, because it is true that in terms of the people that we encounter, the majority of them are women and children. Mazi talked about sexual exploitation abuse, which I feel that as a humanitarian community we're not doing nearly enough of. But there are also other issues to do with female-headed households, which we know in terms of livelihoods face increased difficulty, issues in terms of making sure that we integrate gender responsiveness into our humanitarian response. Mm-hmm. We've also been seeing this real phenomenon in Northeast Nigeria of women and girls being used to carry out attacks. I know a lot of people call them suicide attacks. I don't actually like using that word, because for me, I don't know the degree of will and voluntariness. Mm-hmm. And I would also argue that for an 8-year-old girl or boy, I don't think that we can call them suicide attacks. So I think we also need to be careful about the language and the narrative that we use. Mm-hmm. And again, we just don't know enough about what's happening and why it's happening, and what we can do in terms of our work to address these issues. Mm-hmm. I also want to say that I feel that in the way that we see the violent conflict in Northeast Nigeria, we take a very gender stereotype view of what is happening. And part of that is seeing, just in terms of recruitment, that in some ways men join voluntarily for political, religious, ideological reasons, whereas women are forced to join. And we know that there's some truth in that, but in reality, all the research shows that there is a spectrum between forced and voluntary in terms of association with the group, mm-hmm. and that men and women fall on all aspects of that spectrum. And so often, when we come across men associated with the group, they're taken to screening, they're seen as active agents, whereas women are treated as victims. And I think the truth is somewhere in the middle, yes. and our response should be looking at that. Mm-hmm. I also want to talk a little bit about children. Mazi's talked a little bit about the impact on education. I think it's also important to remember that not only are a lot of children have they been used in attacks, but also looking at issues of trauma, especially for children associated with armed groups. And we have children who have been abducted, forced to fight in terms of Boko Haram, mm-hmm. the armed opposition group, but we also have children who are members who've been recruited and used by the civilian JTF and other vigilante groups. Now, I understand that the CJTF, UNICEF, are planning to put in place a very clear plan of action to prevent this from happening, but we also need to take that into account when we talk about what's happening in the Northeast. And my final point is on people with disabilities, because I don't think we look at this often enough either. And what we find is that people with disabilities find it more difficult to escape violence. They're left behind in communities when the rest of the community leaves. When they escape, they lose their mobility aids, they leave behind their medicines, they may lose their caregivers when they flee, and they're actually at increased risk in situations of displacement. And again, our response needs to look at that. And in terms of vulnerability and need, we have to remember that there's a lot that we don't know, because there are whole areas of Northeast Nigeria that are completely inaccessible mm-hmm. to us. We can't even go there to know what's happening, let alone respond to that. And even the areas that we can go, often it's only the LGA headquarters rather than the areas surrounding it. And so we're lacking access, both in terms of physical access, but also information.
And Kat, there has been a lot of talk about people returning to communities, and I understand that you have some concerns about this. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that we have to remember in the conflict is it's an active conflict, and that means that even today people are still displacing or being able to escape from areas for the first time. And so we've got a very mixed picture of movement in in the northeast of Nigeria, new displacements, people who've been displaced for a really long time, all mixing together and moving around together. Now, at the same time, there is a narrative that has emerged from some sides that because local government headquarters have been secured, that means that it's safe for people who've been displaced for quite some time to start to go back home. And this is because there's a lack of real information. People get rumours from home, they hear about what's happening, they're afraid of Boko Haram still being there, still threatening people. And there's a lot of rumours that have started to emerge. You know, humanitarian aid in camps will be stopped. Officials will not be paid unless they return. And there's a lot of rumour that comes and information that isn't necessarily coming from official sources and isn't being counted very effectively. But it's also true to say that nobody wants to be an IDP. You know, almost all of the IDPs we talk to are afraid of going home, but they want to go home eventually. But their primary concern is it safe enough for me and my family to go back?
Right.
Followed by, is there education for my children? Will there be a health centre in case we get sick? Is the market working? So these are very practical concerns. How can I resume my life where it was before? Mm-hmm. So some people try to go back. They get to their village and they find that their wells have been contaminated. Their farming equipment or their fishing equipment has been stolen and the house has been burnt down. There's nothing left in many cases. And they end up coming back. And the other that happens is that actually for most people, they can't even get as far as their home. When we talk about return in this instance, what we see most often is people getting as close as they can to their homes. And that often means these headquarters that are said to be safe. So that means they're not in their house, they're in a camp, they're mm-hmm. still in an IDP camp and they're still an IDP.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes this is not the first time they've displaced. I mean, 10% of the people that Oxfam talked to in Nigeria have been displaced more than 3 times already. They've lived in 3 different places and now we're asking them to move again.
Right.
And these LGA headquarters are secured by the military. The military has a presence there, but they are militarized. The military are often the only government institution there. There are very limited NGO access. There are no services, except in some of the larger towns with every building. But a lot of these smaller, more, what we call the newly accessible, the ones that have been more recently recovered, there is the military, there's the perimeter, and there's the people inside. There's no market. They can't leave. They can't travel very far out of the town to farm. There's a curfew at night. It's a very restrictive way of living. And it's certainly not, in those instances, without those services, without agencies coming back, would not be a place that anyone would want to return to. You're displacing. And so that's the first part of the problem. And the second part is that we have a real lack of a legal framework to regulate how we support IDPs to return home eventually. The government has signed the Kampala Convention, but it hasn't been adopted and it hasn't been operationalized yet, and we still don't have the IDP policy. So we have a real absence of a framework for us to have these discussions about what this process looks like. Because we have to start to think about, people want to go home. We have a responsibility to facilitate them to do that, but it has to be safe, it has to be dignified, and it has to be voluntary. And there are certain things that we need to provide as a community to be able to do that. We need to give them information about exactly what is happening in their communities, what is left, where would they be going, and what would that look like, so that they can talk to their families, they can talk to their friends, they can make a decision about what is best for themselves. Secondly, we need to let them go and see it for themselves. We call these go and see visits, and it's really important that people don't just receive information, but they can actually see. You know, community leaders can go and see what we're looking at, and then they can report back to communities so that they can then have a discussion and, again, make a decision for themselves. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, we need to be thinking not just about return. For many people, not just in Nigeria but across the region, they saw horrors. They experienced, you know, trauma beyond, I think, most of us can comprehend. And a lot of people in other places have said, how can I go back when I saw what happened? You know, we focus on return because so many people do want to, but there is a significant portion of people who can't because their villages are too remote and they'll never feel secure again, or they just don't want to. And so local integration options, integration elsewhere, are also conversations that we need to be having with people so that there is a range of options and people are able to make the best choice for them, rather than feeling, you know, what we risk at the moment is people feeling pressured into having to displace again and ending up arguably because of the livelihood challenges, because security is very fluid in many of these places, into even more secure, insecure environments that they're currently in. And I think all of us, you know, at minimum want to avoid that and to ensure that people are safe and that they can continue to access whatever livelihood opportunities they have, but also the assistance that humanitarians can provide that simply isn't there, again, in the quantity that we need it in many of these areas.
After Oslo, what are your hopes for the way forward? Talk generally about what are you hoping to see as outcomes from this conference?
Yes, I think this conference has been a really important start in terms of discussing some of the critical issues and raising much needed funds for this response. I think there are two things. I think one, it's not just about pledging money. We need to see this money coming into the response as quickly as possible so that we can start to work with it and we can start to increase the amount of assistance that's available. And I think number two is that we need to continue to see this as a complex and multifaceted context and challenge, and that means that we need to work on improving our coordination as humanitarian actors, government, UN officials. We all need to find ways to be more effective in how we coordinate with each other and on these issues. And I think, as Chitra said, it's really important that we acknowledge that even now we cannot meet some of the most serious, the needs that we assume on the basis of evidence that we've seen before are the most serious, and that's the people who are still trapped in Boko Haram areas that we don't have access to. And we really need to continue to have a very serious and very tangible discussion on what are our options and what can we do to try to reach those people, because it is not enough just to try. We need to meet the needs that we're not already meeting, but we also have to say, we have to be honest and be like, we need to try and find ways to find those people and to help them.
I think, just to echo Kat's points, in addition to funding not only being pledged but also released, I would say that funding also needs to be long-term and flexible. We know that the conflict dynamics are changing very rapidly, and we need to make sure that the response kind of changes along with it. I'd also like to see better working between the international community, the UN, INGOs, also national civil society organisations, and the Nigerian government. And this hasn't been quite as smooth as it could be in the past, and I really hope that Oslo marks a step change in terms of our working together, both in terms of coordination, as Kat mentioned, but also thinking strategically mm-hmm. to overcome some of the challenges that we see. And for me, the biggest challenge really is access to information, access to areas that are affected, but also looking at things such as the ways that bureaucracy sometimes impedes humanitarian action. And the final thing is, and we say this very often as humanitarian actors, that protection is central. We really need to think about what that looks like in the context of Northeast Nigeria and think of a holistic range of interventions, kind of joining the dots and thinking multifaceted, as Kat mentioned, but then think about how all of that can have protection as its centre.
For me, just building on, you know, what both of my colleagues have said, it would be as the funding rolls in for us to begin to think more about quality, the quality of the services. It's abysmal. I'll tell you, it's embarrassing. We need to understand why this is so and look at measures we can put in place, you know, to improve that. And the second would be, you know, to improve in the way that we program, in the way that we provide service. Talk to them. We need to talk to them. Identify their needs according to how they see it, not the way that we think
right.
that they should. That way, I think we would do a lot more and achieve a lot more with whatever funding that we have.
Thank you, all of you, for your work and for your time and in talking to me. Thank you very much.